Okay, perfect. Welcome back, everybody. Hope you guys had some time to network with everybody, set up a coffee, go to the bathroom, or do anything else. But we're just going to dive right in with these two incredible speakers. We're just going to do a quick introduction round, maybe telling who you are, where you're from, and what you do. We always do ladies first, so Carla, you can go ahead.
Okay, well, I'm Carla Rebecki. I'm a hockey player. Well, I don't play anymore for the national team, but I played for 16 years for the national team from Argentina. I retired before the Tokyo Olympics. I was planning to go, but then when they postponed one more year, it was a bit tough. So I decided to dedicate to my family that I have a three-year-old daughter. So I decided to stay with her, and actually I'm playing in Belgium in the Royal Antwerp Hockey Club. This is my second season here.
I'm Tom Craig. I'm from Australia. I'm not as quite a big deal as Carla, and I've played for the national team for 7 years. 16 seems like a little bit too long for me, but anyway, play for Australia. Here I'm in Holland for my first season at KZ, Klein Switzerland, in The Hague. I'm loving it. And yeah, hopefully we can have some fun today.
Fantastic. Thanks for introducing yourselves. Our first question then, Carla, you've kind of touched on it. Playing life balance. So obviously, you obviously, as an athlete, train, you play, you go to competitions. But outside of playing, what are your hobbies, and how do you balance the two? And why is it so important for young people to get the balance of both?
It's a good question, I think. For me, it was always really difficult, that balance, because in Argentina we are used to train a lot. We train every day of the whole year, and we train twice a day. And I started very young in the national team. I was 18, so I was struggling a bit, like with the study. I started studying, and then there were so many hours training that it was really difficult. So it was a bit hard that moment, but I think it was really important to do other things after hockey, because if not, it was all the time you are like focused on hockey and you need to clear your mind a bit. So I always try to study. I never finished my career, but I studied a couple of things that I never finished because of this. It was really difficult, but I always did it also because I needed for my head to do an extra thing. So I think it's good to have other things. I really like to do a lot of sports. So when I have also time or holiday more, because when I'm training I can, but I like to do other sports also. And well, when I'm training, just relax and be more, rest a bit also.
Yeah, I think if I could just jump in there as well, it's easy to just think about hockey all the time, especially A, when you're young and you're trying to make it, but B, also with the international season, it's so long. And you could easily go for 16 years, never really having a proper break from hockey. So it's quite important to make time for yourself and to make those own breaks yourself, like as Carla said, playing a different sport or studying or something like that, because it's easy to just kind of get swept up in the whole hockey thing. And also when things are going well with hockey, it's not so bad, you know, like you can do only hockey because it's going really well and things are good, but that's not really elite sport. Sometimes things don't go well, you have injuries or anything really could happen. So if you don't have something else there, it's easy to just kind of go into a bit of a spiral and just try and like focus more on hockey and more on hockey. But if you already have something to the side, it's not so bad just to like park hockey, like relax, don't worry about it too much and do other things. it's so important. And in Australia, it's kind of similar. So we all moved to Perth. Most of us are from the east coast of Australia, and we moved to Perth. I was 19 when I moved to Perth, and probably for the first few years didn't quite have that balance right. I think, like, I always studied, but for me, like, a social life and just completely forgetting about hockey and having friends who have nothing to do with hockey or don't care or anything like that is so important. So, yeah, if you move cities, like in Perth, it's you move for hockey, so it's easy to just have hockey friends and all that sort of thing. And that's a constant battle, I think, for people coming to Perth, is trying to find something outside and stick to it. So, yeah, it's so important, and you don't know how important it is until things start going not quite so well with hockey. So I would encourage everyone to have something or as many things as possible outside of hockey to enjoy.
Okay, perfect. Then why do you guys prefer to be a top-level hockey player? Why? What's your motivation? Why did you guys choose to be it?
I think that when I started playing hockey when I was young, I started playing when I was 6 years old, I never thought about it. I just like playing hockey and I enjoy it. I made friends in my club and it was really nice. I think I always had like a dream that I saw the national team and I say, okay, I would like to be there. I would like to wear the Argentina shirt and represent my country. I think it was like a dream I had when I was young. So that's why then when I start growing up, I say, okay, well, if I want to get there, I have to train more. I have to do more things to get there. So I think then it was like, it's like a style of life then that you choose to be there, because I really like and I love hockey. I think it's the thing I like to do most in my life. So that's why I also want to do it at that level and representing my country. That is really nice. I think it's an honor to wear the Argentina shirt and represent a lot of Argentinian.
Yeah, I think for me, as Carlos said, you don't really decide to be an elite hockey player when you first start playing hockey. Like it's just fun. And I think the thing that's always kept me playing hockey was more just the friends that I had at my club. And that's kind of what gets you through like your high school, primary school, those sorts of things, because people start going off and playing different sports and anything could have happened. I think, yeah, most Australian kids play a lot of different sports. So it's not necessarily that, yeah, hockey was the one that I liked the most, which I did though. I did like it the most, but also like my friends were, yeah, I really like just going to training and hanging out with them and that sort of thing. And it kind of like, yeah, I'm not sure how it works in Argentina, but it happens quite quickly once you start, once you kind of get identified. As I said, like, yeah, both of us, I think, were quite young. So like 19, I just finished high school and was in my first year of uni and was thinking about a lot of other things other than hockey. And then all of a sudden you kind of get called to play for Australia. So it's like, it's not really much of a choice at that time. It's like, wow, I'm 19. I just got picked to play for Australia. Like, who wouldn't go and do that? And I think even though I didn't think I was going to be there for too long, I was just kind of thinking, yeah, I'll play hockey for a couple of years, try and go to the Olympics. And if that doesn't happen, move back to Sydney and start doing other things. Once you're in that environment, it's very it's infectious. Like, you love it. Everyone's working so hard. And the guys on my team are the best and some of my best mates now. So you just kind of really get hooked on coming to training with other people and then competing in front of crowds and stuff. It's difficult to walk away from that too early and without seeing kind of where it goes. So, yeah, I love it.
Fantastic. We're going to ask the audience their first question. And our first question to you guys is, what would be the best support bubble you could have around you? So whether you're a player, an umpire, or a coach, we've all got our support networks. Tom and Carl obviously spoke about their family, their friends. What's your support bubbles and why are they so important to you? So 5 minutes, grab a table, have a bit of a chat, and then we'll come back and if you've got any questions, we'll ask Tom and Carla.
Okay. If there is anyone who would like to share their answer on the question, please don't be shy. Join us on stage, raise your hand, or just put it in the chat and then we'll pick it up. We're just going to start with the first question. The hockey is a team sport, so the bond among the teammates is very special at the game. What are you guys doing when your team bond among the teammates is broken?
Do you want me to start?
Yeah, you want to.
Fortunately, I think with our team in Australia at the moment, we haven't had to deal with something like this. But definitely, what we say is like team culture is seven times more important than the game plan. So, and I'm not a maths person, and maybe that's a bit of an exaggeration, but really, like how everyone feels about each other. I think is super important, and you can kind of tell with teams that aren't really on the same page, it usually translates to the pitch. So that's definitely something that we take really good care of and make sure that we're first and foremost working together well. You're not going to be best friends with everyone in your team, but if you can have at least like a good working professional relationship with everyone on your team and just know a little bit about them, and I think most importantly is probably just understanding everyone to a certain extent, so then you can like figure out if they're not at their best at training one day or how best to kind of have hard conversations with them, because in high performance it's really important to have an open channel of communication with each other. And if you don't really understand each other very well, then it's difficult to do that. So like as for teams actually being broken, I think the work is probably beforehand to make sure that it doesn't happen so much. You're going to have fights and arguments and stuff, but as long as there's a good base before that, you can kind of avoid having big team fractures, if that makes sense.
Carla, do you have anything to add, or?
I think I agree, and in the national team we also didn't have like some break like that, but I think it's really important. Well, we used to do some activity with like coaching and those kind of stuff. Also in the clubs I played, we used to do those activities and team activities. I think they are really good and get to know each other. And I think you have to be really tolerant in a team. You travel a lot, you share a lot of time with them. Maybe you are like more with them than with your family. So you are not gonna be best friends, as Tom said, but I think you have to get along well and try to make it work.
Fantastic. So then, instead of sort of like the team, what makes a good player? What do you think makes a good player? Or why do you think you are some of the best international players?
I think it's, for me, in my case, I think it's really important, or what it worked for me is that I really trained very hard. When I was young, when I was like in the youth, I wasn't really a very good player. My quality was that physically I was very fast. I could run very fast, and that was my strong point. But I wasn't really skillful, and as I was so fast, I never trained or so much my skills. So when I get to the national team and I started comparing or watching other players, I say, okay, if I want to be here or still be here, I need to do more, I need to train more. So I think there I say, okay, I need to train my individual part, and I started training a lot. And I think for me, that was the thing it worked to get to be a complete player and have everything. I think there's no science, but it's important that you train and you improve. When you practice, then you get to have those qualities. And for me, it worked for like that, like training and I dedicated a lot of time to it. When I went to play abroad the first time in Spain, I had a lot of time, so every morning I went training to the beach with the balls alone and train. So I think that was key for me.
Yeah, I really like what Carla said. Another point is when you train, I think, especially when you're a bit younger, sometimes you can just kind of go to training because training is on. But I think what I maybe figured out a little bit later was how to train. So you could stand on the pitch for 2 hours and not really achieve anything, or you could go to the pitch for 25 minutes and really focus on one thing and like visualize how this skill that you're practicing will work in a game or something like that, and really, really focus on it. And then you can, like, it's worth five times like a normal training session. Like, it's really important to just stay switched on and really focus in those trainings. And I think if I think what makes a good player, I think the best players are smart. Like, they understand where they are on the pitch and where their best pass is or their best option. And I think some of the best players aren't particularly skillful or fast or anything like that, but they just make really good decisions all the time. And with the decision making, I think, like, you have to have a certain amount of awareness. So what we focus on a lot is just, we call it pre-scanning, but just knowing where you are on the pitch, where your next pass is, where, like, if you're in trouble, where you can go to get out of trouble, and that sort of thing. And the other thing I would say is just be really willing to learn all the time, I think. Like, yeah, I think maybe if you're young and you're pretty good, often coaches will just kind of let you do your own thing instead of, like, really try and develop you because you're already good and they need attention elsewhere. But if you can try and get as much feedback as possible and then choose what you do with that feedback, because not everything is going to work for you, and not everything is going to be right even. But if you just have a willingness to learn and then decide whether this is helpful or not helpful and then work on it, then I think that also makes a good player and a good teammate as well.
Okay, perfect. Then we go to the next question. Have you ever found yourself at your level that the coach's tactics are not working and you had to take it amongst yourself as players to change a few things? Did it work? Did it not work? How did the coach react? Maybe how did other people react? Maybe parents around the field?
I don't have a case like in the national team because I think that you are there and you will generally do what the coach says and we don't argue. Maybe you can speak about things you disagree, but I think maybe when I was younger, no, I didn't get involved in those things. So I don't have like an example or something to say about it.
I think, as Carla said, when you get to the national team, I think the coach also trusts you to make good decisions and as a team. So they might give you four or five different ways to play that we've trained. And then depending on what's happening in the game, even though the coach might say, yeah, we're going to start with plan A, if it's not working, he probably trusts us to recognize that it's not working. And without saying anything, we'll just go to plan B. And it's not like we're not doing what the coach says. It's more the coach has already given us the tools to make the decisions ourselves, if that makes sense. But also, like, sometimes coaching is about, like in Australia, we play quite a team-oriented game and there might be general rules. So if it's like a one versus two, maybe try and find a better option, or if there are too many people ahead, reset, recycle and go out the other side. But also, I think most coaches like to see people play with their individual flair. So every so often you might take a risk. And I think the best thing about our coaches, or my coach in Australia, is that he trusts you to make those decisions again individually, even though he might have said another time, like, in this situation, consider not running the ball, pass it out and go around. Every so often, like, I think he trusts us to back ourselves in those situations as well. So, I don't, like Carla, I don't really have any example of just, like, forgetting what the coach said and doing, like, a mutiny boycott sort of event. That doesn't really happen.
Fantastic. So, audience, we're going to ask you your second question now. And when we come back, we're going to ask the exact same question to our two speakers. So the question is, do you have any pre-match rituals before a game, or any sort of things that you do to help you get focused? So you pop in the chat what you do, and then we'll see what Carla and Tom do. So 5 minutes, find a table, have a bit of a talk. The crazier, the better. We love that. Fabulous. Welcome back, everyone. Hopefully you've had some good discussions. So as we said before we went into sort of our tables, we'd ask Tom and Carla what their maybe pre-match rituals are. So Carla, do you have any? And if they are, what are they?
It's not nothing. I don't have like nothing special, but I like before the games to be like quiet or listen to nice music. And then when I played in the national team, we used to go in the bus to the matches, and we always go with music and singing. And then when we get to the stadium, we had a ritual that we always move the bus with a song. So we made the bus move, and yeah, it's funny because they always put it everywhere, the bus moving, and some they don't like that we move the bus. The man that drives the driver. So, but it's funny. It's like a ritual we always had there. But then I don't have nothing special, or I don't do anything like the same all the time. I just want like to be a bit relaxed before and concentrate in match and that.
Yeah, for me, I don't. I'm the same. I wouldn't have anything like some guys have. Some people like would warm up without shoelaces on their shoes or something like that. Like. Things like that. That's not really, I don't do that. But what I do is just make sure that I'm quite relaxed before a game. Realistically, you probably should already have like done the work, I think, like the week before or whatever training. That's when you can kind of put pressure on yourself to work hard and train hard and that sort of thing. But once you get to game day, I think it's more about up here. So just for me, that's just like being super relaxed. Know that I've done everything I can and then just go into the game with a nice relaxed attitude. Other guys really like to fire up and be really like pumped up before a game. I wouldn't have a ritual. Maybe if it's a later game, like a night game, I'll try and get a sleep in just because it's easy to start thinking about the game if you have the whole day to think about it. So I like just distracting myself, staying relaxed and asleep if it's too far away.
Okay, great. If there is anything from the audience they would like to share their ritual, you can always put it in the chat or raise your hand and then we'll ask you to come on stage and share it. Then we go to the next question is, what do you guys do to calm your butterflies while you're competing against a high-level team? Carla, if you want to start.
Nerves or anxiety is always happens me like in the moment you are going to listen the national anthem, and I think that's the moment you feel that. But for me it's like it's a nice moment. I really enjoy that moment. It's really, I don't know the word, but it's really nice. I really like it. And then after that, I think when the whistle blows and the match starts, it's like everything goes away and I'm focused on the match and on playing. So I think that's what I do. I think that I focus on the game and everything disappears in that moment.
For me, I think they're pretty normal. Some games I wouldn't get them. I'm not sure why or why not. Usually like early in the tournament, maybe the first game of a tournament, you might get them because like you're nervous and excited about how it's going to go. But once the tournament's kind of started, then it's a bit easier to just kind of focus on my job. I think sometimes as well, like depending on how mentally you prepare for a game, like there might be other things at school or something else going on in your life, and like a little bit of stress there can pass over into your hockey. I think that's kind of like and you get the butterflies. I think sometimes, like, I used to get really kind of frustrated with it, like, oh, I just wish I could play, like I didn't want to worry about these things. But I think once I kind of understood that it's quite normal, and also it's actually a good opportunity to test yourself, you know, like it's easy to play hockey when you feel good and life's great, but it's more difficult to play really good hockey when other things are happening or you're nervous or something like that. And I think if you can prove to yourself that it doesn't really matter whether you're nervous or not nervous and you can still perform, I think that's something that's quite powerful and can be a nice little challenge for yourself. Like, yeah, even though I feel really nervous, how cool would it be if I could play really great and just kind of let that go? And I think every time you do that, you get a bit more confident being able to deal with the butterflies and still play well.
Fabulous. So the next question is based around decision making. So how do you think you can train younger players on decision making? I'm going to kind of link two questions together here. So what is your advice then for younger players to get professional like yourselves? So Carla, how do we get better at decision making and become a 16-year international like you?
I think that you improve your decision making with the training and with the years. It's something you are getting with your experience, and when you have passed for more situations, and then you are learning. And I think you always have to be open to learn and listen what they are correcting you or telling you. So if you are open for learning, it's easier also, because you can do it maybe faster. But I think it takes time, because it's part of your development as a player also. So you have to be also patient if you are young, and because it happens to me, it still happens to me that I make wrong decisions. So it's part of, it's impossible to do everything perfect. But I think it's something you get with the years and with experience also, and with training and having those experience.
Yeah, I would say actually exactly the same as Carla. It's funny, you still see like the young players come on and they're all kind of the same. Like, they're obviously different, but they make like young mistakes, which are basically just like the wrong decision. Like, they think they can do something, or they think it's the best thing to do, and it's usually just like maybe they're too excited or something like that. And it's very those sorts of things you start to kind of grow out of, just because you've done it so many times, and once you're a bit older. And as Carla says, like, I'm not really sure you can teach that. It's more just experience. But yeah, also she says, like, I think you can maybe speed it up a bit by thinking or by watching video or something like that. You can learn a little bit faster. I think, and also just encouraging maybe your young player just to think about these things and try and understand why that decision was right or wrong, or how they might do it differently. But I think it's more just like thinking about the decisions, and the more you play, the more you're going to do that anyway. So.
Okay. Is it something you guys do during the halftime? Like, if you're playing a game, the coach says, decision making, this wasn't good, this was not a good decision, this was a good decision. Is that something that happens during the halftime on a top level game or not? Tell me if you know.
Sorry, I didn't hear well the question.
No worries. Is that something that happens during the halftime? If the coach says, yeah, this decision was a good one, this wasn't a good one, to change it or not?
Yeah, I think yes. There are some corrections that they do in the halftime, and also maybe during the game when you go out of the pitch and they make you some correction and say, okay, here I think you should have done this or this, or this was good. I think that in the halftime they speak like more generally, but maybe then they say, okay, if it's something very big, they say, okay, this no, this yes, yeah, I think it's it's a good moment.
Yeah, I think sometimes the best advice coaches give are like in big games, just to maybe relax a little bit, because sometimes decision-making, poor decisions come off being too like stressed or too fired up, or you try and do things too quickly, as opposed to just kind of like relaxing and making the right decision. So, yeah, sometimes the best advice that coaches give is just to take a little bit more time, or, yeah, go back to your basics or something like that.
Okay, on to goalkeeping. Maybe neither of your speciality, but we'll take your opinion on it. So I'm a goalkeeper and I don't have the experience that the other 10 players have. You'll definitely have other experience though, so don't knock yourself. What do you think about your team's goalkeeper when he missed an easy goal that he can block? So they make a mistake, we all do, it's humans. What do you think? And more importantly, how do you help them pick themselves back up?
I think it's really important always to be positive and help everyone in your team. They are your teammates, so you need them all to be good for playing, good for the match. So it's good always to help them and say nice words. And I think when you are positive, it's better than criticizing, or because we all make mistakes, we are not perfect, and always it can happen to us to make a big mistake or whatever. So I think it's important to help and to be positive.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think the difficult thing, like goalkeeper is such a hard position because you might only get one touch a game, or I think for us it's kind of easy because if we make a mistake, the best thing that helps forget that mistake is just to go and get the ball again, you know, or do something, communicate something like that. Whereas keeper, it's like you might make a mistake in the first minute and then don't touch the ball for the rest of the game, and then maybe you touch it in the last minute, you know, and you have to kind of move on from that first mistake. So it's a bit more difficult. But I know what our keepers focus on is just communicating. So if they did make a mistake or something like that, A, it really helps for us to, as Carla said, get around them and be positive and say like, yeah, it's okay. But then also it's their job to make sure that they're mentally right for the next thing. So how they do that is they talk to the people in front of them, they organise defence, they do those sorts of things, because you never know when you're going to be needed, I think.
Okay, thank you very much. We're already 45 minutes in, so that means we have to end this session, unfortunately. Thank you very much to the both of you to be here, having all the questions, having all the answers, and hope to see you next time.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone, and it was nice to be here.